The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne, read by Michael Learned.
Chapter 1. The Prison Door. A throng of bearded men in sad-colored garments and gray steeple-crowned hats, intermixed with women, some wearing hoods and others bareheaded, was assembled in front of a wooden edifice, the door of which was heavily timbered with oak and studded with iron spikes. The founders of a new colony, they recognized it among their earliest practical necessities to allot a portion of the virgin soil as a cemetery, and another portion as the site of a prison. That first prison house, built by the forefathers of Boston, was already marked with weather stains and other indications of age which gave a yet darker aspect to its beetle-browed and gloomy front. The rust on the ponderous ironwork of its oaken door looked more antique than anything else in the New World. Like all that pertains to crime, it seemed never to have known a youthful era. Before this ugly edifice was a grass plot much overgrown with burdock, pigweed, apple peru, and other unsightly vegetation, which evidently found something congenial in the soil that had so early borne the black flower of civilized society. But on one side of the portal, and rooted almost at the threshold, was a wild rosebush, covered in this month of June with its delicate gems, which might offer their fragrance and fragile beauty to the prisoner as he went in, and to the condemned criminal as he came forth to his doom, in token that the deep heart of nature could pity and be kind to him. Finding it so directly on the threshold of our narrative, we could hardly do otherwise than pluck one of its flowers. It may serve to symbolize some sweet moral blossom that may be found along the track, or relieve the darkening close of a tale of human frailty and sorrow. Chapter 2. The Marketplace. The grass plot before the jail in Prison Lane on a certain summer morning centuries ago was occupied by a pretty large number of the inhabitants of Boston, all with their eyes intently fastened on the iron-clamped oaken door. The solemnity of the demeanor on the part of the spectators befitted a people amongst whom religion and law were almost identical, and in whose character both were so thoroughly interfused that the mildest and the severest acts of public discipline were alike made venerable and awful. Meager and cold was the sympathy that a transgressor might look for from such bystanders at the scaffold. On the summer morning when our story begins, the women, of whom there were several in the crowd, appeared to take a peculiar interest in whatever penal infliction might be expected to ensue. Morally, there was a coarser fiber in those wives and maidens of old English birth and breeding than in their fair descendants. The beef and ale of their native land, with a moral diet not a whit more refined, entered largely into their composition. The bright morning sun, therefore, shone on broad shoulders and well-developed busts, and on round and ruddy cheeks that had ripened in the far-off island and had hardly yet grown paler or thinner in the atmosphere of New England. There was a boldness and rotundity of speech among these matrons that would startle us at the present day. "Good wives," said a hard-featured dame of 50. "It would be greatly for the public behoof if we women should have the handling of such malefactresses as this Hester Prynne. What think ye, gossips?" "People say," said another, "that the Reverend Master Dimmesdale, her godly pastor, takes it very grievously to heart that such a scandal should have come upon his congregation." "The magistrates are God-fearing gentlemen, but merciful overmuch," added a third autumnal matron. "At the very least, they should have put the brand of a hot iron on Hester Prynne's forehead." "Ah, but," interposed more softly a young wife holding a child by the hand, "let her cover the mark as she will, the pang of it will be always in her heart." "What do we talk of marks and brands?" cried another female, the ugliest and most pitiless of these self-constituted judges. "This woman has brought shame upon us all and ought to die." "Mercy on us, good wife," exclaimed a man in the crowd. "Is there no virtue in woman save what springs from a wholesome fear of the gallows? Hush now, for the lock is turning in the prison door, and here comes Mistress Hester Prynne herself." The door of the jail being flung open from within, there appeared in the first place, like a black shadow emerging into sunshine, the grim and grisly presence of the town beadle, with a sword by his side and his staff of office in his hand. Stretching forth the official staff in his left hand, he laid his right upon the shoulder of a young woman whom he thus drew forward, until on the threshold of the prison door she repelled him and stepped into the open air as if by her own free will. She bore in her arms a child, a baby of some 3 months old, who winked and turned aside its little face from the too vivid light of day, because its existence